Well, welcome, everyone. We're glad you joined us here for a basic conversation. My name is Brad Rieger. I'll be your host. And as always, we have Father Jim Basic joining us. And Father Basic, this is our third season.
Yes, we've done quite a few of these, Brad. And the people who use them for all their walking got enough to walk a couple miles yet.
We want people to have content for their walks and drives just other reflections.
Or those dealing with insomnia.
For sure. And we want to say a thank you to WGTE for being a great host and a great sponsor. We have Chris Pfeiffer, the great senior producer and project manager.
And we owe a lot to them. They do a great job. I love working with Chris.
Yeah, great people. So this season three, we're focusing on 12 theologians that you've selected and you've written about, you spoke about, and they've had a direct impact on you, but also globally on the church and on the culture and society. And so it's a little bit different than our first two seasons, but I think it's going to be really informative and interesting.
I'm looking forward to it. Let's go.
And our first one that you selected is Hans Kuhn.
Yeah.
And we're going to go, because you've had some direct experience with him personally, in addition to his writings and his lectures and great teachings, we're going to focus on the impact Kuhn has had on you personally as a theologian, as a priest, and as an individual. How about that?
Yeah, I hope that when I'm speaking so personally about my relationship with Hans, and that it somehow has a universal value. I want to make sure we save time to point out the general message he has, not just his impact on me, but on what message he has for people as a whole, which I think is still important.
Right.
He died a few years
recently,
ago.
Recently, yes.
Yeah. Yes. So just to keep that in perspective.
In my recollection, he did come to the University of Toledo and spoke. I remember seeing him, and it was a wonderful presentation.
It was in the student union. Yes. Yeah, we had a large crowd at the University of Toledo,
Yes, it was really...
There's a story behind that.
It was a great one. So I just mentioned that personally, that to read some of the some of his writings before this interview here. Yeah. It took me back to that time.
You were there. Good. The 80s, yeah, that was
Laura
an amazing event.
It was a great event. So how do we want to start?
Well, let's talk a little bit about my interactions with Kuhn. So let's do that. And again, I'm speaking personally, hoping it's got some value for others as well. But to put in some context, Hans Kuhn wrote a book before the Second Vatican Council. Second Vatican Council is ancient history for some people, but occurred between 1962 and 65. And Kuhn was involved in that council as a young theologian. And before the council began in 1962, he wrote a book, The Council Reform and Reunion. Council Reform and Reunion. And so throughout his whole life, what he was interested in is reforming the Catholic Church, but for a purpose, that is to bring Christians closer together and to be able to unite with others in working for justice and peace in the world. So I was on a study sabbatical in New York in the 60s, and I took a course from him at Union Theological Seminary. That was a live place then. Many of the outstanding Catholic theologians, who some people would know, Bernard Herring and Ray Brown and people like that, were teaching there. So I took Hans's course on ecumenical sacramentology. Mm-hmm. Now that word ecumenical is what we use to talk about the whole effort for Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox to come closer together. So he taught the course trying to show very much how what Martin Luther said about sacraments were close to what Catholics said, and that it was, closer than we thought. And always, all the way along the line, that's what he said. But anyway, the course was wonderful. I couldn't write fast enough. And I got a chance to talk to Hans sometimes after class.
What struck you as a student? Why were you so engaged? What was so engaging about that class?
He was charismatic. He was comprehensive. He was open for dialogue. He was a charismatic figure, spirit-filled. So anyway, I took that course and, you know, talked to him a bit. I never would say I was a close friend of Hans Kung's, but I got to know him a bit. And in the evening, once a week, he gave lectures at the Riverside Church, which I went to as well. Packed, that big church was filled, and he was talking about the church and truthfulness in the church. And I mean, I think at the end of that lecture, he said, "Now let's all march someplace." People would have gone. So he had a quality of him. He was like a skier. He was a vibrant man, a man's man in many ways. And anyway, I went to those lectures in the evening, and that's where I felt, more than in the class, I felt the power of his charisma, and how he could move a big audience. He loved to talk to large groups. So those lectures were just outstanding. Truthfulness. It has all of the importance of truthfulness. I think we could take that and apply it to U.S. culture today, in terms of how we're trying to get along, and instead of having alternative facts, of having some sort of basis in truth. So it has great relevance yet for today. So I got to know him a little bit then, and started reading more of his stuff, his books. And so the next event occurred, I mean, in terms of he periodically came to the United States and went on lecture tours and went around. And in 1982, I would say, maybe 83 maybe, he was going to be a professor at University of Michigan, took a position at University of Michigan. We got to get more background material. But anyway, to finish this story, so he, when I heard that, I called him, and I said, he was somewhere in Germany at that time. I called him and said, well, you're right up in Michigan. We're just 60 miles away or less, and you can come down and give a lecture at the University of Toledo. So he says, I hate to disappoint you, but I'm not going to do that, he said, because I've made a rule generally that if it's drivable to Ann Arbor, you got to drive to Ann Arbor. I'm not going to any place that's like an hour or so away. So I'm ruling that out. It was kind, and I said, too bad. So time is coming for him to come, and one day I get a call from the University of Michigan Religious Studies Department, and they say, Kung can't make his first class. Would you come and take his class for him? I said, well, I'll think about that. Of course, I said, I'd be glad to do that. So I go up and I take it. I had his syllabus. I tried to follow his notes and do what he was going to do, but I had my own science on it too. So I did the class. I got good reports on it and so on. So when he shows up for his next class and I met him, he says, I want to thank you. That was wonderful to do my class. He said, you know what? I'll come to the University of Toledo and give a lecture. I said, oh, okay. That would be nice. So he came, and that's a lecture you would have heard.
Yeah.
I think it was 83, and Full House and so on. Again, he was talking about Martin Luther, as he often did, and how. And also, always he had the idea the church must be reforming itself. Another biographical note about Kung, at one time he wrote a book called Infallibility and Inquiry, and he saw, his point was that he was wondering if we really can say that the Pope is infallible, and he was questioning that. And it was at that time, with the publication of that book, he had altercations publicly with my mentor, Karl Rahner, a great German Jesuit. And Rahner was critical of Kuhn and said, he's not talking like a Catholic theologian. And he really went after him. And Kuhn went back after him. This is all in the public journals, you know. And
by name they went after each other?
Oh, yeah, by name, yeah. And Kuhn said harsh things about Rahner. It's hard for me to explain what he said, but it was harsh. And he accused Rahner of being nothing but a company man. Nothing but, always defending the church no matter what. Mm. That was sort of his point. And back on point, after Kuhn gave that lecture that you heard, he was staying at my house for a while, and I was talking to him, and he confided in me then something that I did not know, that he had reached out to Rahner, the younger to the older, and said, let's get together for lunch, and they reconciled at that point. Hmm. But in the result of that book, and Valerie Kuhn was then no longer able to teach as a Catholic professor of Catholic theology. The Vatican squelched him and said he's no longer fit to teach Catholic theology. So he continued to teach at Tübingen, but they made his course as part of an ecumenical institute so he could still teach, right, which he continued to do. And then I'm thinking, I wrote a number of things about Kuhn, and he sometimes responded. One time he responded, he says, well, you got to see how my thought developed. You know, he says, you're talking about a lot about ecumenism, Catholics, Protestants getting together and so on, but my whole project is much broader. I'm trying to have dialogue with the Chinese wisdom traditions, Confucius and Lao Tzu, with the Indian mystical traditions, Buddhism and Hinduism. He wrote books about all those dialogues. So he's trying to get the world religions together. And in 1993, he came to Chicago for the World Parliament of Religions. It was a major event, people from all over the world. And Kuhn gave a talk, really important talk, about developing a global ethic. He wanted to bring the religions together to work for peace. And one of the statements that I often use that he made on that occasion was, no peace among the nations without peace among the religions. No peace among the religions without genuine dialogue among the religions. And a phrase that I paraphrase to say, and no real dialogue without looking at our fundamental beliefs and convictions honestly. So that became, I've often used that at ecumenical talks or in interfaith talks. No peace among the nations without peace among the religions. No peace among the religions without genuine dialogue. And no genuine dialogue without honest reflection. So he's always wanting to go back to the importance of renewal of the church. The Catholic Church had to renew itself. He thought that if all the Christian churches, the more we got closer to Christ and his teaching and were more faithful to Christ, the closer we would come together with one another. Mm. I could go on forever. No.
This is fascinating because it's the behind-the-scenes look at your relationship with Hans. Besides the charisma that you experience as a grad student, what resonates most with you?
Well, that statement that he got into the council documents. Incidentally, he was at first excluded from coming to the council. Remember, that was 1962 to 65, Second Vatican Council, wrote through 16 documents, some more important than others, and the one on the church. And Hans was on some of the commissions working on it. and he got into a fight with Cardinal Ottaviani, a curial officio. Ottaviani, to give a sense of him, his motto, Episcopal motto, was Semper Idem, which means always the same. Mm. And so Ottaviani was big. Nothing ever changes in the church. It's all the same. And so on. And so there's no reform. But, and then against Rahner's advice, Kung dropped out of the commission, backed off, and didn't participate anymore. Rahner thought that was a big mistake on his part.
And did he drop out of protest or just?
Yeah, it was a protest, yeah. That Ottaviani was too powerful and mm-hmm. couldn't.
He was a very conservative.
He was the leader of the conservative, curial, official Roman episcopate, the bishops and cardinals.
And the curia, if I'm saying that right, was one of Kuhn's main targets. Like, it's too powerful. It's not really about Jesus. It's about power.
And, very critical, Very critical of that. But anyway, to answer your question, it did get into the council document, and Rahner helped with this, was the church must always be reforming itself. So it's not we're just having this council right now for 62 to 65, but that's the project of the church always. Church has always got to be reforming itself. And always the criterion is fidelity to Jesus Christ. Christ as we know in the Gospels. Christ who stood up for truth and for justice and for the oppressed and so on. So, that was that idea has stuck with me, and sort of shaped my own priesthood in a sense. The church has to be in dialogue with the modern world, and the modern world changes, and new situations come up. Like we're trying to figure out how the young people are going to deal with cell phones. How are parents going to deal with cell phones at their dinner table or whatever? So, I mean, it keeps moving. And so church must always be reforming itself,
And when he, the ecumenism is obviously a big piece of his ministry. How does that play out today? Like, what's the relevance to that today?
I mean, that would take another two programs. Yeah. But, the ecumenical movement today in the United States is sort of at a standstill. But we had major events. Let's do this. Kung, again, important. His own doctoral dissertation, so many of us theologians, whatever our doctoral dissertation was, shapes our thing. So I wrote about Rahner, and now Rahner got in my bones and blood, and the great German Jesuit. And so he wrote on what we call justification. So the big argument between Protestants and Catholics was, in a sense, that Catholics think, the Protestant reformer said, Luther and so on, we got to have scripture alone, faith alone, and grace alone. We call it the three solas. That's Latin for alone. Scripture alone, faith alone, grace alone. And that the Catholic approach to justification, that is how God loves us and will save us and how, deal with our sinfulness and so on. So Kung's doctor dissertation tried to show that Catholics and Protestants hold the same view. And to justify that, he called upon the great Protestant theologian, Karl Barth, spelled B-A-R-T-H, Karl Barth. And Barth said, Kung's got it right. The thing we've been fighting about over 500 years is we don't have to fight about it. Kung says he represented my position correctly. So that's a major thing in his dissertation. So in 1999, Catholics and Protestants arrived at mainly Lutherans to start with, arrived at a joint declaration saying that the problem of justification is solved. When you look at what we hold today, weak Protestants. And what Catholics hold today, there's nothing that would keep us divided. Nothing would keep us from coming together. There, that fight that we had for all these years since the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, is we can overcome, we have overcome. And later on, Methodists signed on to that, other denominations, Protestant denominations. So that was a great breakthrough. And I think since then, I don't detect a whole lot of progress. I mean, that was such a big break. That was the major dividing point, justification. And so we ended up saying, no, we're saved by grace alone. Protestants, we Catholics can say that, mediated to us by Jesus Christ. And there were statements that said, well, we have to cooperate with that grace. No, but it is by grace alone that God saves us. We don't do it by ourselves. So Kung had a role in that, too. He was like, in 1999, his dissertation was approved publicly by Catholics and Protestant leaders.
Did the ecumenical question, did Kung get into Islam and or Judaism?
Yeah, usually, Brad, we use different language for that. We call it ecumenism is when Catholics and Protestants and Orthodox Christians are trying to get together, and we've had a strong ecumenical movement now for a long time. Right. When it turns to, say, Catholic dialogue with Buddhists, we usually call that interfaith dialogue or interreligious dialogue. And that's what Kung wanted to stress as his life went on. That's what he wrote that letter to me saying, that's good stuff you're writing about my ecumenical efforts, but write more about my interfaith.
The broader question.
Yeah, interfaith, yeah. And that's what takes us to the Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1993, and that sort of work that he continues on. Now, in that realm, there are a lot of things going on. Now, I must say this. Hans Kung spoke publicly a lot, and he was often critical. He was very critical of Pope John Paul II, very critical. And he tried to meet with him a number of times. The Pope wouldn't meet with him. And he thought that Pope John Paul II was retarding the reform of Vatican II, that he was retrenching, going back, and not being faithful to the council. He thought the same thing of Pope Benedict. He was a friend of Benedict, Dave Ratzinger. When Ratzinger was a theologian, Kung and Ratzinger were together and interacted and so on. He did get a meeting with Pope Benedict, but they didn't get any place. Mm. So he was just, you know, look, the council was a major event. We got to follow it. All they're doing is retarding it. He said John Paul II will be remembered as being against women, that he doesn't understand women and he's not playing. So now Pope Francis becomes Pope. Hans is still alive, and he's much more positive. He sees Pope Francis as carrying on the mission of the reform of the Church. And surely, I think, surely that is true. And so a lot of the events, you know, that you try to bring that up to date today, a lot of that is the efforts of Pope Francis to engage. So Pope Francis has worked closely with the Patriarch of the Orthodox Church, trying to work on climate problems, for example. And Pope Francis is... picked up on Hans Kung's thing that we must see our Jewish friends positively. I think there's a, you know, a current thing. We look in the United States, what's our problem? You know, shooting people in synagogues. There's more anti-Semitism going on right now than we've had for a long time, and the famous shooting in the synagogue. So now we are coming out and saying that's wrong. And there was a scriptural basis, that Christ's blood be upon us and our descendants. And the Second Vatican Council took up that question and said, we Christians cannot say that Jews are God killers. We cannot use that language. we have no Jew today was responsible for the death of Jesus, you know. And even at that time, it was the Roman governor who gave the death sentence to Jesus, because the Jewish people could not impose the death sentence themselves. So that the Second Vatican Council, in a document on interfaith relationships, you know, made that clear, that we are close to the Jewish people. We are their descendants in faith. We are with them as in reverencing our father in faith, Abraham, along with our Muslim friends. And we had anti-Semitism goes against the best instincts of the Christian message. So that today our American bishops did a good job of condemning the anti-Semitism rise that we see right now in the United States. It's been happening for a number of years, and so that's another thing that, you know, is building on what Hans Kung said. But again, he loved Pope Francis, and he thought Pope Francis got it right, that we have to carry out the reform. It's one way of thinking. What's the whole mission of Pope Francis? Is to be faithful to the Second Vatican Council, and that we haven't got around to appropriating that completely. Oh, he said, takes many years, maybe generations or centuries, to appropriate the message of a council. One of the messages is Christians must see the Jewish people as our heirs in faith, our brothers and sisters, you know, and so that we must challenge anti-Semitism. We can't just be silent or don't worry about it. That's their problem. It isn't their problem. It's our problem in the United States. And it's around the world. It's not just the United States. There's a lot of anti-Semitism around the world. So Hans is favorable to trying to overcome that.
Yeah. Let's finish up this segment, bringing it back to the personal from the global. What would you say, Father Basic, is the greatest impact that Hans Kuhn has had on you?
Yeah, maybe you've said that in various ways. Maybe I can bring it back. I mean, I feel very blessed that I was his student. And the class opened my eyes. I mean, when it was in the seminary, Protestants were seen as bad people. Our seminary studies were polemical, as we say. That's a word meaning that was based on to show how Protestants were wrong. And so I come into a classroom saying, hey, Martin Luther had great ideas. Many of what Martin Luther wanted, you know, to have the chalice for the people. So we finally got it. 500 years later, Martin Luther said, God had more emphasis on scripture. Now if you go into a home and there's a Bible on the table, it might be a Catholic home and not necessarily a Protestant home. So those things, Martin Luther, the vernacular, the Mass in English, that's all stuff Martin Luther wanted. And so it just gave me a whole different outlook on that. I would say, I shouldn't say that way, because I got a lot of that openness from my own family. So that was too strong a statement. What it did was give me a solid theological basis for what I received from my family, an intuition, an instinct that Protestants are good people and have a lot to offer, and they're not our enemies like they portrayed it in the seminary. So maybe a better way of saying, he gave me a solid theological basis for holding the open attitude towards Protestants and Jews and other religions that I got from my family.
Yeah. Your mom and dad were the precursor to Hans Kuhn. I like
that's
that.
That's for sure, yeah.
Well, that's a great way to end it. Father Basic, thank you for sharing some great stories, some great perspectives on obviously a powerful force in theology, Hans Kuhn.